Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Rich Orman. I'm with the District Attorney's Office. I represent the people. What this appeal is about are two separate concepts. One concept is an illegal plea agreement, and that's what the trial court based its decision on that we're appealing. The other concept is whether the guilty plea itself was knowing and voluntary, and that's our position, that's what the law requires the court to look at, whether the guilty plea was knowing and voluntary. And what the trial court did in this case, and what we're appealing, is conflating the concept of a plea agreement with the concept of a Rule 11 advisement of a knowing and voluntary plea. Rule 11 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure requires a number of things when someone pleads guilty. It requires that the court advise the defendant of the possible penalties that they are facing. It also requires things like advising of you're giving up your right to a jury trial, you're giving up your right to cross-examine witnesses, you're giving up all these other rights. Another thing it requires is to make sure that the defendant understands the plea agreement. In order to effectuate this, the courts are given Rule 11 advisements. Sometimes courts give these to defendants orally. I guess that we don't see that very much anymore. You might see that if a person is deaf or they can't read or something like that. Now we give Rule 11 advisements generally in written form, and then the judge goes through that and makes sure the person understands it. And the purpose of that Rule 11 advisement is to make sure that the person understands what they're pleading guilty to and what the possible penalties are. But to get to the Rule 11 advisement, you have to get to the guilty plea. And that's where the plea agreement comes in. In this case, it was a plea agreement for count 25. And what it said was 10 years to life, SOISP on count 25. There was a plea agreement for another count, count 26, which later became count 27 because of a technical error. And that said DOC, 9 months DOC with a period after that of 2 years of mandatory parole. That is a legal sentence for that count. 10 to life SOISP is a legal sentence for count 25. The sum total of the plea agreement for those two charges was contained within the four corners of that document. It's a plea agreement of the parties.
So to me, Mr. Orman, the question is, do you have to advise the defendant about the parole consequences of a sentence to probation?
Yes, Your Honor, you do. And there are two cases that say that. Dawson, People versus Dawson, and People versus Young. Dawson is found at 30 Pacific 3rd 213. Young is 30 Pacific 3rd 202. They came out the same day from the Supreme Court in 2001. Both of those cases indicate that even if a person is pleading guilty to probation, or even if a person is pleading guilty to community corrections, which does not have a parole component, under both circumstances, the person does have to be advised of mandatory parole. Yes, they do. And also People versus Craig, which I think is really the main case in this area, indicates that as well. The person needs to be advised of the mandatory parole. But the question...
So if you go to that stage then, and the parole advisement by the trial court here was simply and followed by a period of parole.
Yes.
Whereas in the request to plead guilty, it says 3 years mandatory parole.
Yes.
In the sex offender addendum, it says 10 years to life indeterminate parole. Right?
Correct.
So which is the defendant supposed to believe?
Well, Your Honor, the question, I think, is, well, that's a number of answers to that question. One is the real issue, as far as Craig is concerned, is whether or not that misadvisement of the 3 years, which is in the Rule 11 advisement, is harmless. And I think it's harmless for a number of reasons. One is it's harmless because the defendant was, in fact, advised of the proper term of parole following a release from prison if he were to violate probation, hypothetically, get sentenced to prison. He was advised that if he was released from prison within his lifetime, because he was advised of 2 to life as the possible prison sentence. So if he was paroled during his lifetime, he would face 10 years to life parole. So he was correctly advised of that.
He was, but he was also told 3 years mandatory parole.
He was told that as well, Your Honor. Now, what Craig indicates also is that a defendant bears a burden. I'm sorry, not Craig, Your Honor. I'm getting my cases. I believe it's Chavez and Craig both say that the defendant, if he is confused, if he is given some type of information that he doesn't quite get in the course of the providency hearing, should bring that to the attention of the court and bears a burden to do so. So here we do have a defendant that is given, in fact, two different terms of parole in his advisement. He's given that term of 3 years in the Rule 11 advisement. He's given that term of 10 to life in the addendum. Says he understands it all. Signs it, says, yes, I understand, Your Honor. I read the addendum and I understood it. I read the Rule 11 advisement and I understood it. There are two different things in those, but nobody mentioned that. The defendant didn't say anything. Counsel didn't say anything. The court didn't say anything.
What flows from that, though?
What flows from that, Your Honor, is the question of whether or not that is harmless. So if you look at what Craig says, how do you decide whether it is harmless? And what Craig says is that you have to look at what the defendant is advised of, the total possible sentence that the defendant is advised of, versus what the defendant is at risk of receiving. So in this case, what is the defendant advised? In fact, let's just say he's only advised, for hypothetical purposes, only advised of that incorrect three-year mandatory parole, not even advised of the correct 10-to-life mandatory parole. For purposes of this discussion, the 10-to-life advisement doesn't even exist. He's only advised that he could face 2-to-life in prison followed by 3 years of mandatory parole. So let's look at what the analysis that Craig mandates comes from that. What does Craig say? You look at A. I'll do it this way, Your Honor. Let's make it a mathematical equation for purposes of looking at this. A would be, in that mathematical equation, what he's advised of. B would be, in that mathematical equation, what he possibly faces, or as Craig would put it, what he is at risk of receiving as far as a sentence is concerned. So A would be a 2-to-life prison sentence, because nobody denies that he was advised properly in the rule 11, in the addendum, by the court, that if he violated SOISB, he could face 10-to-life in prison. Nobody seems to dispute that. It's in all three of those. So he's advised of that, that he could spend the rest of his life in prison, plus 3 years of mandatory parole. When you get to the point of advising someone that if they violate their probation, they face an indeterminate prison sentence of at least 2 years, up to the maximum of the remainder of their natural life, that sort of pigs out, doesn't it? That's sort of the maximum you can advise anyone of anywhere. You could spend the rest of your life in prison. As far as advisements for sentences go, it doesn't get any higher. I could jump to the top of this room, I wouldn't get any higher than that. Plus 3 years. So if you want to make it into math, the highest theoretical possible number, infinity, for purposes of advising someone of a possible sentence, that's infinity plus 3 years.
Mr. Armin, under your example, wouldn't it render just there be no need to ever advise anyone of their indeterminate parole if they're facing indeterminate prison up to their natural life?
Well, Your Honor, that's a very good question. And the real question, though, under Craig is, would it be harmless not to do so? Not whether you're required to do so, because clearly the law says a court needs to do that. But the real question is it harmless not to do so? And I would say under Craig, anytime a judge would say, no, I'm not going to advise a person of the parole because I've advised them of the potential of life in prison, is that improper? Yes. Should a judge do that? No. But is it harmless? I would say in every circumstance, under the rule that Craig lines out, yes, it would be harmless because they've been advised of a sentence that they could spend the rest of their life in prison. If the sentence that they face is equal to or less than that under Craig, it's harmless. In other words, the person is advised, yes, you can spend the rest of your life in prison. Well, okay, they plead guilty. Unless they can do something spending more than the rest of their life in prison, unless they're at risk of doing that under Craig, it's harmless. So I would say, yes, a court should do that, Your Honor, but it's going to be harmless if a court doesn't under this sentencing statute. So if A, what you're advised of, is greater to or equal to B, what you can possibly face, it's harmless. And here he was advised, you can spend the rest of your life in prison plus 3 years.
So if it was a term of years, for example, then we'd have a much different situation, because whether you got 10 years to life on parole would be substantially greater than a three-year mandatory parole.
That would be correct, Your Honor. Well, let's say the situation was the person was not, it was not an indeterminate sentence. It was, let's say, a 10-year sentence, and they were not advised of parole. And the possible sentence that they faced was 53 years or something along those lines. I think under Craig, that would not be harmless. But Craig makes it clear that if you, and the other cases that follow it, Your Honor, Dawson and Young, two other cases, and those are actually the cases that say, yes, you have to advise the person of the term of mandatory parole. Those are the two cases in Colorado that came up with that concept. You have to do that advisement. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court found that the lack of advisement of the term of mandatory parole was harmless. because the defendant was facing a sentence or received a sentence, I think in both of those cases, that was less than the total amount, prison plus mandatory parole, that they were incorrectly advised of. And that's the real question. That's the real thing that the court needed to decide in this case and didn't. The court looked at the plea agreement, and the plea agreement clearly called for a legal sentence instead of looking at what the defendant was advised of and what the defendant faced. And what the defendant faced was the life in prison. What he was advised of was life plus 3 years, and that's harmless. And if it pleases the court, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Andres Guevara, and I'm appointed to represent Mr. Dana Westcott in this case. And I want to start off with one very basic introduction, and I want to deal with some of the arguments raised by appellate that I think are the ones that I want to address with first. And as an initial matter, there are three different parole terms discussed in the documents that Mr. Westcott was given in 2009. In the plea agreement, it says 2 years. Now, the plea agreement doesn't actually say those 2 years relate specifically to count 26. We know that it matches with that. But the 2 years, if you're signing the plea agreement, that's the amount of mandatory parole that Mr. Westcott was bargaining for.
Let me ask you this. That's paragraph 7 that discusses count 26?
Yes. Paragraph 7 does mention count 26. It also has a section there for mandatory parole.
And yes. Is that under paragraph 7 or is that a different paragraph?
It can be read as being on the, it's definitely on the same line as paragraph 7, but there are two different counts that are mentioned in this document, count 25 and 26. So it depends on whether or not you interpret the mandatory period of parole as related to count 26 specifically and uniquely, or if you say that what we're dealing with in this document is the aggregate and the maximum that you can get under any one of these circumstances. In other words, that if you were being cautious in this particular fact, and if you're being proper, even if you had two separate counts, what you would do is you'd put the higher of the two mandatory paroles under the mandatory parole section so that you're advising the client, the client's agreeing to the fact that whichever one of those mandatory parole periods is, the higher one's the one that he's going to be subject to. So for example, in this case, 10 to life would have been the proper way to have pled this in a plea agreement when you're dealing with count both 25 and 26, which have substantially different parole periods. Now that's one document. This is actually the plead upon document. So Mr. Westcott objectively, because it is objective standard, could say, hey, look, what I'm agreeing to here is 2 years, because that's the mandatory period of parole in my plea agreement. Now, there is a Rule 11 advisement. The Rule 11 advisement, 3 years. Also incorrect. The only correct document that gets it right is the sex offender addendum. And in the district court, the judge, using contract law, because of course the Colorado court says you can look at contract law, right? You can actually look at things beyond contract law because you're dealing with constitutional rights here. The judge says, look, in terms of priority, handwritten documents like the plea agreement have priority over typewritten documents, which are the Rule 11 advisement, have priority over boilerplate documents, which is the sex offender addendum. So that what we have here are three completely different parole periods. Mr. Westcott testified, in fact, the only evidence presented at the 35C hearing, that he thought that he was dealing with a 2 or 3 period of supervision after prison time. I do want
to... But that means, let's go to the crux of the matter. After prison time could be the remainder of his life.
It could, in fact.
And under that scenario, your opponent argues that it's harmless, even assuming that that the parole period is incorrect somewhere.
I understand. I think that interpretation is incorrect. I absolutely think that the Craig decision, first of all, there is a period of these cases that deal with omissions. So for example, they deal with the fact that an individual was not told the parole period in their plea document, but was either somewhere else, like an oral advisement or in the Rule 11. So what the court is trying to say is we're not going to read into an omitted parole period, some other term that would make the agreement illegal. So I understand that. But what ends up happening is if you assume that that's the case, then you've turned the parole issue on its head. This is an indeterminate parole period. What Mr. Orman's argument would mean is the most serious parole cases provide the defendant with the least amount of protection. Because the Colorado Court, the Supreme Court has said very clearly, people have to be advised of their parole term. The parole term for count 25 is as high as it gets, 10 to life. And what the argument that the petitioner or the appellant says is that the most serious parole period doesn't have to be told. Even if it follows after a prison sentence, which I agree, clearly, Mr. Westcott could be sentenced, could go to prison for the rest of his life on the prison sentence. Of course, he could also go to prison for 2 years, because that's the front end. So he could serve the minimum. And in fact, he may have already done that time. What's to be expected after you've completed your term of prison? And that's parole. It is critical that an individual facing a 10 to life parole period be informed that. It is part of the decision making. It is part of the process that he or she has to go through in terms of making a plea. If the Craig decision is taken to that logical extreme, or I would argue illogical extreme, what it does is it seems to abrogate the purpose of parole in these cases. I submit to the court that what it does is says that the most serious parole cases, it's okay if you don't tell the defendant. It's perfectly fine. Why bother? What's the point? It's okay. Yeah, because in prison, he could do the rest of his life. He could do 2 years, but he could do the rest of his life.
Well, Craig seems to say specifically that, though, doesn't it? It says you have to be advised of the risk that you're facing by pleading guilty. Mm-hmm. So when the trial court goes through the Rule 11 advisement, it talks not about the plea agreement, but about what he could get with his plea of guilty to that particular crime.
Agreed. And Craig, the issue with Craig, and this is one of the part I bring up with omission, is in the Craig case, they were looking at they were looking at a situation where an individual was promised a 5-year period of parole within the documents. He was correctly given one of the documents that contained the 5-year period of parole. In the plea agreement, there was an omission completely. Now, the 5-year period of parole fit within what he was already sentenced to. And in fact, the defendant's argument was, I had agreed to a cap, right? And it's an argument that some of these other cases talk about, which basically says, hey, I was advised that I could at most do 5 years. So when you give me an extra period of 5, that's an extra 5 of my liberty that's taken away. That's a different situation from here. And I think the Craig court was attempting to say, look, first of all, you were told of an additional 5 years. You're properly advised of the correct law. There's no ambiguity about it, whereas Mr. Westcott has considerable ambiguity. And the case law says you read ambiguity in his favor. That is clear from the cases that are cited. Tolbert is one of the cases that I present. You read ambiguity for Mr. Westcott, not for the government.
Well, Mr. Guevara, when you've got the ambiguity we're talking about is the plea agreement itself. If there's an ambiguity, you read it in a defendant's favor.
Yes.
When you're separately talking about an advisement and there's inconsistencies in advisement, we've got the case law that says if there are inconsistencies, it's up to defendant to bring that to the attention of the court.
I understand. But first of all, I would argue that the plea agreement itself is not ambiguous. The plea agreement says 2 years parole, right? So I don't think that that's ambiguous as to the four corners of the document, that right now the pled for term of parole is 2 years. If you determine that that's not going to be the case, that in fact that relates to something entirely different than count 25, and again, this court can make that ruling, frankly, because it's objective. It's an objective standard. Then the question is, what extrinsic evidence can you review? And I think the case law says you can look at other things, right? You can look at the sex offender addendum. You can look at statements made by the court. Now, the statements made by the court don't particularly help anything because he was never properly advised. He was never properly advised originally and subsequent to that point.
Okay, so if we agree on the record, he got a variety of advisements of what parole could be, whether
right.
it's the 3 years in the Rule 11 advisement and the addendum, which says indeterminate life. So is it defendant's obligation to bring that to the court's attention? And if so, he didn't do so here. So then what do we do with that?
I think under these circumstances, and again, there's some factual issues that the district court judge, I don't remember if the district made any specific rulings regarding that. I mean, there is the issue in this case that Mr. Westcott's attorney was switched on the last particular date. I don't know whether that has any particular impact because there was no direct testimony on it. But I think that Mr. Westcott could have objectively determined at the time that it was not ambiguous, that it was that he had gotten the 2 years that were specifically set out for him. I think the way I read these cases in relation to that is that with regards to the parole issue and what he's doing here, I don't know that he can bargain away that particular responsibility. At the end of the day, it is an illegal sentence. And he could not, for example, have moved to enforce this particular sentence if the court finds that the 2 year parole is part of the illegality of the plea agreement, regardless of whether or not he himself knew about it or didn't know about it at any time.
When you're referring to this as an illegal sentence, the sentence he received was 10 years to life of the intensive supervised parole.
Of probation.
Probation.
Yes.
All right. So is that an illegal sentence?
That part is not.
Okay.
The parole component is.
And what is the parole component of the sentence he actually received?
Well, the parole component that is part of the plea agreement would be the 2 years. Right now, that's assuming, again, I'm reading the plea agreement as saying that the parole, mandatory parole, after you've gone to prison is 2 years. The appellant's argument is that it's omitted as to count 25, right? That, in fact, this 2 years is to be read as related to count 26. I don't think the district court made that particular ruling. I think the district court's ruling was whether it's two or three, there's a problem with the parole period in this particular case. So I think objectively, a person can look at the plea agreement and say, mandatory period of time is 2 years. That's what's to be expected after you go to prison in this particular case. And I think that that's a reasonable interpretation of the plea agreement as it's written. And so that a person could say that's a 2 year period of time. I think that that's, but again, I do think that the Craig decisions, there are other cases that dealt with omission that are cited. They include Chavez, Dawson, Larson, Benavidez, all are cases in which the plea agreement is silent as to the issue of parole, but that there is an advisement orally or in the Rule 11 that was properly done. And in fact, I believe many of those cases it was orally done. So somebody was told, on the record, you could get a 5 year period of parole. So it becomes harder, obviously, to justify, hey, I've been told this in court by the judge. Where's the issue here at this particular point? You understand it. And those courts are dealing with that particular issue and molding an argument so that they say, look, this is at that point, under these circumstances, that would be harmless. You already knew it. In some form, you may have been told that you were properly advised in that particular case. Here, there has been no proper advisement.
Counsel, I want to try to understand it.
Sure.
And I may have misunderstood you, but I thought you said the plea agreement, the four corners, is not ambiguous. It's not ambiguous, the four corners of just the plea agreement, not including the other documents. But
yes.
Then as I understand further, it sounds like you're saying, but the 2 year parole could be equally interpreted to count 25 and 26. So are you saying it's ambiguous?
Let me be clear. I don't think the plea agreement is ambiguous. I think the parole period is 2 years in the plea agreement. It says 2 years mandatory parole. This court can disagree. can say.
Your position in 2 years as to count 25 or as to both? That's how it should be interpreted.
It should be interpreted that the maximum period of parole, the maximum amount of restitution, the maximum amount of fees, that what the plea agreement is an aggregation of what a person's looking at and what they're agreeing to. So that in aggregate, what the person's saying is, when I've completed whatever period of supervision and or prison that I can get subject to, the mandatory period of parole that I'm bargaining for, that's the plea agreement, is 2 years. And so, and that's what it says here in the plea agreement. The district court's ruling was to say, look, whether it's two or three, that's material, that's a material difference from what a person's looking at in terms of 10 to life on the parole issue in this particular count 25. And my position is that it's not ambiguous. I think that the plea agreement speaks for itself. And the plea agreement says 2 years mandatory parole, which is illegal. If the court disagrees with my ruling, and says we've looked somewhere else, the only place in which Mr. Westcott was ever properly advised of his parole period was in the sex offender addendum. Nowhere else. The Rule 11 says 3 years, which is also incorrect. And he was never orally advised by anyone about that situation, neither in 2009 or subsequent to that point. Guys, I see my time's up. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to respond to a few things counsel said. Counsel indicated that all of the cases that follow Craig regarding the harmlessness of a misadvisement involved the court actually properly advising the defendant of the term of mandatory parole. That is actually not correct, and I would direct the court to both Dawson and Young. In both of those cases, Dawson, I believe, he pled guilty to a probationary sentence. In Young, I believe, he pled guilty to a community correction sentence. So neither of those cases involved direct sentence with a mandatory parole component or any type of parole component. And in both of those cases, the court did not inform the defendant that he faced a term of mandatory parole. And in both those cases, the Colorado Supreme Court said that that was harmless to do so, even though there was no mandatory parole advisement at all. What the defense argument is regarding count two is that, I'm sorry, regarding count 26, later count 27, is that paragraph 7 of the plea agreement promised him 2 years of mandatory parole as far as any sentence in this case would be concerned. And that is, I think, if you look at the plea agreement in any type of objective fashion, is not borne out by the format of the plea agreement and the way the Providency hearing went. Paragraph 2 of the plea agreement says probation, 10 years to life, SOISP on count 25. And that is the sum total of paragraph 2. Paragraph 7 says DOC, 9 months on count 26, mandatory parole, 2 years. And if you follow the Providency hearing and the documents, it's clear that the defendant was advised it's probation for count 25. It is DOC for count 26. There are separate sections actually in the Rule 11 itself that outline the possible sentences for those two counts. And the Rule 11 portion for count 26, later count 27, correctly notes 2 years, the same as in the plea agreement. If you look at the plea agreement in an objective fashion and look at all the factors of it, it demonstrates that the defendant was advised he was getting probation for one count, DOC followed by parole for the other. What the defendant is essentially saying, though, is that he was promised a term of parole in the plea agreement for count 25. Well, if you look at the cases that discuss parole, if you look at the cases that discuss plea agreements for probation, and if you just look at the general way, I mean, you all see lots of cases flowing through on the great river of cases that flow through this courthouse. Plea agreements for probation do not contain parole components in the state of Colorado. And why is that? When someone pleads guilty to a probationary sentence, if they violate that probation, it is up to the court to determine what is going to happen as a result of that probation violation. I would cite the court to CRS 1611-206-5. And what that says is if the court finds that someone has violated their probation, the court can do a number of things. One is the court can do nothing. The court can say, yes, you have violated your probation, but I'm going to continue that probation. sort of, you get a freebie on this one. You get a pass for that violation. The court has discretion to do that. Number two is the court can impose any sentence authorized by law for that offense. So if it's a sentence that authorizes a prison sentence, the court can sentence to prison, or the court can resentence to probation, which the court in this case actually did, because the defendant previously had been had his probation violated. There was a two-day hearing for that probation revocation, and at the end, the court found, yes, you have violated your probation, but I'm going to resentence you to another term of 10 years to life SOISP. It is within the discretion of the court to determine what happens after a probation violation. And what counsel would argue and what the defense's argument is well, the court in this case, if the agreement of the parties was if the defendant hypothetically violated his probation and the court hypothetically sentenced him to prison, well, he's going to get 2 or 3 years of mandatory parole. And I would say that if you look at the documents in this case, they are not capable of that reading. They are not capable of looking at that and saying, okay, that is what the parties agree to. It is in total derivation of Colorado law and the rules of criminal procedure.
Is there a statute or a case that you can cite to us to help us find authority for the proposition that parole does not attach to a probationary sentence?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question.
Maybe I misunderstood your argument, but as I understood what you said, it was that in all the cases we see come through here, we don't see a parole component attached to a probationary sentence.
Correct. In other words, you don't see an agreement for a parole sentence when the plea agreement says the person is going to get parole.
But is there authority that says it does not need to have a parole component?
Well, I would say it can't have a parole component because if you look at the statutes out defining what probation is probation is a time and a period where the person acts at their good behavior under certain conditions that are imposed by the court, and at the end of that, the sentence is over. There is no parole component to any probationary sentence in the statutes in Colorado. I don't know how to, I mean, I guess you could say, I could say, well, look at any statute defining probation. You won't find parole in there.
Okay.
So I see my time, well,
I do have one quick question.
Sure.
So it's your position that the advisement was insufficient, however, it is harmless.
I would say the advisement was ambiguous, and the advisement should not have happened in that fashion. I don't know if insufficient has some technical legal consequences that I'm not aware of, so I don't know that I want to say it was insufficient. It should not have been done that way. It should not have said 3 years in the Rule 11 advisement, but under People versus Craig, it is harmless.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will also stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.